introductions out of the way, our topic for this morning, Rock of Ages for the Modern Age. Rock of Ages is what? What is that? See, it's funny. I hear people say Rock of Ages is Moe's sword. So, number one, Rock of Ages is not a translation. The song is not a translation of Moe's sword. And the words Rock of Ages are not a translation of the words Moe's sword either. So we're going to talk about that. What Rock of Ages is and what the song Moe's sword is. The song Moe's sword is traditionally sung on Hanukkah. As we will see, it's actually been sung on Hanukkah for quite a long time, at least 600 years. We have an older Hanukkah song called Hanerot Halalu, which dates back at least 1,800 years. But still, 600 is not so bad. If you take a look at the first source on the sheet, this song is neither 1,800 years old nor 600 years old, but I can tell from the last that at least some people are familiar with it anyway. Adam Sandler is hardly somebody who I normally put on a source sheet. But I remember when this song came out, his Hanukkah song, for those who may not be familiar, it's where he goes through celebrities who are Jewish or who he wishes were Jewish or he wishes were not Jewish, but they are, depending on the people he's talking about. He started this on Saturday Night Live. It's got to be, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago at this point. But his introduction, the first time he did it, was the following. When I was a kid, this time of year always made me feel a little left out. Because in school, there were so many Xmas songs. And all of us Jewish kids had was the song Dreidel, Dreidel, Dreidel. So I wrote a brand new Hanukkah song for you Jewish kids to sing, and I hope you like it. And they did. I mean, it became quite the hit. So much so that there were at least four different versions of it at last count. So, it's true that we don't have nearly as many Hanukkah songs. What Hanukkah songs do you know besides Moe's Sur and or Rock of Ages? What else do you have?
Oh, Hanukkah,
right? I had a little dreidel, or as he calls it, dreidel, dreidel, dreidel. And Aner Halalu, right? Me and Malayo, that's a good one. Okay. Yiddish translations of songs is a whole other field in which I have no familiarity.
Nearly, nearly, nearly,
right? If you go to Israel, you get more, okay, as you might imagine.
There is another
one, right? Me and Malel was mentioned. Good. That's all right. No, that's just fine. So he's not correct that there are no Hanukkah songs. At the same time, the truth of the matter is, we don't have that many. So we ought to take advantage of the ones we do know, because they have meaning to them. They're not just, you know, random agglomerations of syllables. If you take a look at source number two, this is my source for how old Moe's Sur is, at the minimum. Rabbi Yosef Ben Moshe was a student of a well-known Austrian rabbi from the 14th century, Rabbi Yisrael Isserlein. Author of a work of Jewish law called Truma Kadeshin, among other things. And Rabbi Yosef Ben Moshe wrote about the religious practices of Rabbi Isserlein. And he talks about, in this section that I'm quoting here, number two, he talks about Zmirot, the songs that Rabbi Isserlein used to sing at his Shabbos table. And he says, on Friday night, he sang Kol Mikadesh, and he sang Ma'i Yidud Menuchatech. These are both traditional Friday night songs. Sometimes another song called Ma'yafit. And sometimes he would sing another song related to the day, like Ma'oz Tzur Yeshuati on Hanukkah. So that shows you that the song was being sung already back then. I don't know how long before. This is the earliest mention of which I am familiar, which suggests that this is probably somewhere around when it was becoming popular, but it doesn't tell us anything definitive, only that by then the song existed. It makes a lot of sense to sing Moe's Tzur Yeshuati at the table Friday night on Hanukkah, because you're always in a rush. Hanukkah is at this time of year where it's a short Friday, right? And you have to light before you start Shabbat, and there's no time at that point to be standing around singing Moe's Tzur. You didn't only sing the first verse. Like, you're crammed for time. So it makes more sense to say to the kids, listen, we're going to light now, we're going to sing later. Or, well, right now, we'll give you presents now, and we'll sing later. There's no time. Interestingly, we don't know all that much about the creation of Mo's Sur. The name of the author seems to be Mordechai. I haven't liked that name. But the name of the author seems to be Mordechai just because of the acronym for the paragraphs. The first paragraph begins with the letter Mem, second one with a Resh, third one with a Dalet, and Yud. So therefore it's assumed that it's that the name of the author is Mordechai, except the last verse, which comes afterwards, which is assumed to have been added later. Cantor Bernard Beer has a short recording online where he talks a little bit more about the origin of the song as well as the origin of the tune. The classic tune, the Mosur Yeshiv, right? That tune is claimed to be universal among Ashkenazi Jews. So everybody does it according to that tune, and he claims that it traces back to two German folk songs that somehow got blended together to create the tune to Mosur. It has that German sound to it, and that's, Truman Hadesh would have fit that as well. So where does Rock of Ages come in? Take a look at number 4. The translation for Mosur is on the back in number 9. You can see it's obviously a lot longer. Yeah, we've got multiple verses. That's like, I'm American, I grew up with the Star Spangled Banner, and, the truth is, there's a lot of verses that nobody sings. Mosur also has more verses than people are necessarily familiar with. We're going to be going through them. But in number 4, courtesy of Wikipedia, I give you the lyrics to Rock of Ages. It's interesting, and I'm going to want to talk about what exactly they chose to put in and to take out. But anybody know who wrote Rock of Ages? So one of the authors, there are two authors, they work together on it. One of them is actually a very well-known name within the Beit Midrash, within Jewish study halls. One author was a Reform rabbi by the name of Gustav Gottheil. The other one, Rabbi Marcus Jaskow. Anybody ever hear of Marcus Jaskow? So they were both Reform rabbis in the 19th century. Rabbi Gottheil was in New York City. Rabbi Jaskow, I believe, was in Philadelphia. But Marcus Jaskow is, frankly, better known in many circles for his work in creating a dictionary of Aramaic. He created what is considered more or less the definitive dictionary used when studying the Talmud. And I was shocked when I found that he had also written Rock of Ages. I had no idea he was into music. But if you look at what's here, it tells you a lot about 19th century American Reform Judaism. Rock of Ages, let our song praise thy saving power, thou amidst the raging foes wast our sheltering tower. Furious they assailed us, but thine arm availed us, thy word broke their sword when our own strength failed us. So in other words, there were enemies who attacked us, and God, you took care of us. Right? That's more or less, I think, a summary, minus the wasp and amidst and whatever, thine. Kindling new the holy lamps, priests approved in suffering, purified the nation's shrine, brought to God their offering. And his courts surrounding here in joy abounding, happy throng singing songs with a mighty sounding. So he invokes another aspect of Hanukkah, which is the lighting of the lamps, right, in the temple, and the joy that came with it, the purification of the nation's shrine. And then, the third, last paragraph, children of the martyr race, whether free or fettered, wake the echoes of the songs where ye may be scattered. Yours the message cheering that the time is nearing, which will see all men free, tyrants disappearing. So, a call for freedom, right? Wake the echoes of the songs, right? It's a very nice song. I have nothing against the song, but yeah. There is a Christian hymn called Rock of Ages as well. And I don't think it's accidental that they chose that title. I think it's Gottheil, put together a hymn book which became used by American Reform Jews, called the Union something. and it includes Christian hymns within it. But Rock of Ages is a translation of Hebrew term Sur Olamim, which is not Mother's Sur, but it's Sur Olamim. That's what it's meant to be. It's the eternal rock, the rock being God. But in terms of what they choose to include here, or what we choose to exclude here, flip the page for a minute. Take a look at the first paragraph of Ma'oz Tzur. This is the Art Scroll Sidur translation of Ma'oz Tzur. So look at the first paragraph. O mighty rock... This is not working.
No, that's a magic marker. That's not going to work either.
No, that's... That's Marjorie over there.
I'm here.
Hang on. I'm just going to see. I think I just had to reset it. Yeah, I'm good. Thank you. Okay. O mighty rock of my salvation, to praise you is a delight. So far, sounds very similar. And go there again. Give me one more shot. O mighty rock.
No.
Okay. I'll leave that. Maybe the battery's dead. Okay. Back in business. O mighty rock of my salvation, to praise you is a delight. Restore my house of prayer, and there you will bring a thanksgiving offering. Notice this one doesn't rhyme in English. Sorry. When you will have prepared the slaughter for the blaspheming foe, then I shall complete with a song of a hymn the dedication of the altar. So again, it's talking about the lack of rhyming. What are the differences between what you saw in Rock of Ages and what you see here? Now, this one isn't working.
It's not working. I don't understand. He saw you, and we're going in the dark.
I can actually do this without the mic. So let me just go without the microphone. Thank you, though. Okay. So, what's the difference between what you see in the first paragraph of Ma'oz Tzur and in Rock of Ages? Yes? Yeah. The Hebrew is much more intense. I like that word. The slaughter for the blaspheming foe is one that you did not see in Rock of Ages. What else?
What is the future and what is already the past?
What do you mean?
When you will have prepared. In other words, this is going to be after the event. This one is already the past.
It's asking for the future. It's asking God, restore my house of prayer. We will bring a thanksgiving offering once you have prepared the slaughter for the blaspheming foe. I think Ma'oz Tzur is future. Rock of Ages, you're saying, is past?
Well, it's now. It's, you know, present.
Present. Yeah. I suppose. Right. The Ma'oz Tzur is referring to and indeed surrounds a future event, at least in this first paragraph. However, when you read the rest of it, you find that the middle four paragraphs here, there are six total, speak about the past. Let's take a fast look. We're going to see more of that. But look at, just quickly, number nine. The second paragraph here speaks about a particular period of trouble in Jewish history when we were under the thumb of the calf-like kingdom. Calf-like kingdom is? Egypt. The prophets compare Egypt to a calf. We're going to come back to that and I'll explain why. It talks about how we were slaves in Egypt and God took us out. What's the tip-off in that paragraph that's talking about Egypt? Pharaoh's army. Right. And then the next paragraph after that is speaking about another oppressor, which is? Babylon. Zerubbabel was our leader when we emerged from Babylon, but it's talking about how we suffered under the Babylonians. The paragraph after that is about how we suffered under the Persians, right? Haman the Agagite was our chief enemy in the story of Purim, but it's about how we lived under the Persians. And then the next one is, of course, the Greeks, right? And then the last one, anyone know? Well, come back to the last one. The last one is about a secret enemy. We'll have to get to that. But those are the foes that we're talking about here in Ma'oz Tzur. And how much of that made it into Rock of Ages? None. The whole story of Jewish history, of the empires under whom we live, is simply missing. So Rock of Ages, number one, eliminates this line about the slaughter of enemies. It eliminates much of Jewish history, and it eliminates one other element, which is the desire to build the temple anew. Right? That's gone. That's not here. Right? Whereas in Moses Surah, the opening paragraph is exactly that. Restore my house of prayer, a reference to the temple which is called in Isaiah the house of prayer, Beit Tefillah. We'll complete with a song of hymn the dedication of the altar. That's not found. And as I said, this makes sense. Because Rock of Ages being written in 19th century Reform America, the desire to build a temple in Jerusalem is not on the agenda. The idea of slaughtering the enemy is certainly not within the language that that they would be speaking or would be comfortable with. And the whole idea of Jewish history and the enemies who oppressed us and all of that is not something that they particularly wish to remember or associate with. So Rock of Ages jettisons that. But my question now is, leave aside Rock of Ages, what is the message of Ma'oz Tzur, of the original Rock of Ages, if you will, for a Jew in the 21st century? This is not a random question. Survival, we're going to talk about that. But I want to expand the question first. Because music is fundamental to Hanukkah. It's not just something to do while you're waiting for the latkes. The latkes are something to eat after you sang the songs. The songs are the essence. And more than that, the songs are not something to do while the candles are burning, but actually the songs, on one level, are more essential to Hanukkah than the candles are. Which is surprising, because you go to school and you think, well, everything is about the Hanukkiah, right? Everything is all about the candles. Not necessarily so. Take a look, please, at source number 5. I acknowledge that this is going to be surprising. That's a good thing. This is the Talmud's description of the Hanukkah story. The Talmud does not have a volume set aside to discuss Hanukkah. There were some who suggested that that was on purpose. Because Hanukkah, who are the good guys, so to speak, the victors on Hanukkah? The Maccabees, the Chashmonaim. What happened after the Hanukkah story with the Chashmonaim? After that, well, everybody knows. No, they became the kings. The Chashmonaim were priests, and they took the monarchy, and that was considered a transgression, which was validated as a transgression when they also became Hellenized. Because in the generations after Hanukkah, they become more Greek than the Greeks. The people who had thrown off the Greeks adopted Greek practices. So that one view of why the sages did not play up Hanukkah in the Talmud is because they don't want to hold up the Chashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, as role models. Because of what went on afterwards. And you see that, if you take a look at source number 5, then the Talmud does have a description of Hanukkah. It comes up in the laws of Shabbat candles. In the middle of the laws of Shabbat candles, you get a discussion about Hanukkah. And the reason for that is because we have certain rules about what you can use for Shabbat candles. Shabbat candles should not use a fuel that smells bad, because you want them at your Shabbat table and you want to enjoy them. And they shouldn't use a fuel or a wick that will flicker, because you can't adjust the lamp on Shabbat. So you have to make sure you use something that's going to burn well. Hanukkah candles, on the other hand, you're not supposed to use them for yourself. They're just supposed to represent the miracle. They're not a lamp for you to read by. And therefore, there's less of a concern about what you are actually using. And so the Talmud does a contrast between what you use for Shabbos candles and what you use on Hanukkah, and that's its excuse to launch into a discussion of Hanukkah. So here's the description in number 5. What is Hanukkah? Our sages taught, on the 25th day of Kislev, there are 8 days of Hanukkah. which we neither eulogize, when we neither eulogize nor fast. These are days that are celebratory days if a funeral happens. So normal eulogies aren't conducted. You don't hold fasts on Chanukah. Why? For when the Greeks entered the sanctuary, they contaminated all of the oil in the sanctuary. And when the monarchy of the house of the Hashmonaim mustered strength and defeated them, they searched and could find only one jug of oil marked with the seal of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. There was only enough to kindle for one day, but a miracle occurred, and they kindled from it for 8 days. The next year, they established them and made them Yamim Tovim, celebrations, with Hallel and thanks. So, what's missing in the description of what they enacted the next year? Sorry? What's missing? Sorry?
Lighting of candles.
Lighting of candles. That's not there. Presents are also not there. They have not yet been exposed to North American late modern commercialism. So no, presents are not listed there. The truth of the matter is that Jewish history has a practice that goes back thousands of years of giving presents in advance of holidays as a way to fulfill the biblical command of being joyous on your festivals. So the biblical holidays, Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, are supposed to be to involve giving gifts. The idea of Hanukkah and having gifts more likely comes from imitating our neighbors. Hanukkah gel also, right? Hanukkah gel is also a practice. Yeah. Yeah, you think money doesn't count also? I think they take cash. Pretty sure. She said that maybe Hanukkah presents are like the neighbors, but Hanukkah gelt is not. I'm not so sure of that. But in any case, the passage in the Talmud that gives us the sort of capsule origin of Hanukkah says nothing about candles. Not only that, I didn't bring it on here, but in the liturgy on Hanukkah, the Amidah includes a special paragraph. It's also found in the blessing after meals called Al HaNisin, which is recited. And it also gives us the history of Hanukkah. Talks a little more about the war than this version does. But it also doesn't say anything about lighting the menorah, lighting the Chanukiah. It says that when they won, they lit lamps in Chatzrot Kodshecha, in the yards of God's temple. But that's not the same thing as having menorah, having Chanukiah, depending on what you call it, in people's homes. In fact, sorry. No, we were doing candles before they were doing candles, but not the. But we're going to come back to that. Let me just go in a little bit of order. Something else. There is a prayer known as Hallel. Right, people are familiar with it. What makes up Hallel? What is in Hallel? Yes, but I mean, where does the text come from? Tehillim, right, Psalms. Chapters 113 through 118 of Psalms are Hallel, and they are recited when? Holidays. Right, the biblical holidays. Passover, Shavuot, Sukkot, right? It's said on those days. It's said on Chanukah as well, right? It is said today, Yom HaAtzma'ut, Yom Yerushalayim. But Hallel is a way, on Rosh Chodesh, the first day of the new month. It's said on festivals. That's when Hallel is recited. So, Maimonides comes to write his code of Jewish law. It's called his Mishneh Torah. And he breaks up the laws for everything you could think of in Judaism into different sections. If you were Maimonides and you wanted to decide where you're going to put the laws of Hallel, where might you put them? Laws of what? Where would they fit? I would have put them either in the laws of holidays, right? Or in the laws of prayer. Right? Because it sounds like a prayer. However, Maimonides puts it in the laws of Hanukkah. Puts it in the laws of Hanukkah. Clearly there's a close association between singing And in Hanukkah, I neglected to mention, my point in mentioning the Al HaNisim prayer, is that it says that we establish those days, the days of Hanukkah, Lahodot ul-Halel l'Shimcha HaGadol, to thank and to sing to God's great name. So singing to God is a basic element of Hanukkah. I'll go one step further with that before coming back to Ma'oz Tzur. Rabbi Aaron Cutler was a leading rabbi in New Jersey in the 20th century in Lakewood, New Jersey. And he noted something very interesting. There are two kinds of Hallel. And here I'll use the whiteboard because I haven't used it yet. There are two kinds of Hallel. We say Hallel, we said on Passover. We say Hallel on Shavuot. We say Hallel on Sukkot. We say Hallel on Rosh Chodesh, the first day of the new month. And we say Hallel on Chanukah. I'm leaving aside the modern holidays, Yom HaTzmaut, Yom Yerushalayim. But these are your basic days when you say Hallel. Which one of these is not like the other? Hanukkah. Why is Hanukkah not like the others? You're allowed to do everything, yes? Rosh Chodesh also, what do you mean?
Well, you can work.
You're allowed to work, right? So the truth of the matter is, there is indeed a distinction between the first four and Hanukkah. These four are biblical. Hanukkah is rabbinic.
Yeah.
Which makes sense when you think about it. I know no one can read that word rabbinic, written that far down. I apologize. But Hanukkah takes place when? When is it? No, I meant year. What year? You're talking about the 160s before the Common Era. The Bible is closed before then. Like centuries. The last event we have recorded in the Bible is the return to build the Second Temple and the early years of the Second Temple, which happens, depending on whose version of history you take, somewhere between the year 516 before the Common Era and the year 350 before the Common Era. Right? It depends on whose chronology you use. There's some dispute. But for sure, that's long gone. The last events in Tanakh are recorded 200 years before you get to the story of Hanukkah. Hanukkah is rabbinic. But not only that. Another difference between them is this. Passover celebrates what? Getting out of Egypt, right? Shavuot? Dicey. Shavuot, biblically, is not about the giving of the Torah. The first fruits, meaning that even though it's true that Shavuot turns out to be the day when the Torah is given, the way the Torah describes it is that it's actually about bringing the first fruits. It's Chag HaBikurim, when you bring the first of your produce to the temple. Sukkot celebrates what?
Harvest.
The harvest as well as God's protection in the wilderness. We lived in huts in the wilderness. And Rosh Chodesh celebrates what? What is it about the Nimah? We're werewolves. Like what?
I guess it would be lunar.
It is lunar. So the truth of the matter is that Shavuot very clearly and Rosh Chodesh very clearly are about offerings to God. There are special sacrifices that are brought on that day. These are about a korban. There's also a special korban that's brought on Sukkot. Each day a different one. And on Passover as well, there is a special korban to be brought. Hanukkah, though, because it's rabbinic, has no korban. There's no sacrifice. There's no sacrificial ritual. Even though it was observed in the Second Temple time, the rabbis did not create sacrifices. If it's in the Bible, we do it. You can't create other sacrifices. So what that means is this, and this is Rabbi Aaron Kotler's point. He says there are two types of Hallel. There is
is hallel that you sing as part of a korban, as part of a service to God. There's a ritual. God said, bring these sacrifices, sing these songs. Hanukkah, though, is different. It's only about a miracle. It doesn't have the sacrificial ritual. It's a different sort of a thing. It's not a song that accompanies a sacrifice. It's a song in response to a miracle. And here he says what you see here in source number 7. Even that which a person sees with his own eyes, he needs to interpret for himself that which he sees and to establish it in his mind. In other words, singing on Hanukkah is a way for us to process what we experienced. It's the way in which we teach ourselves to understand what happened. When a person goes through a life-changing event, they need to talk it through. They need to discuss it. In some cases, that's therapy. Right? There's a need to have a conversation with someone in which you work through what you experienced and what it's going to mean going forward. And that's what goes on with the songs of Hanukkah. It's an attempt to process the experience of the miracle. So, take a look at number 8.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, you bet.
You are dividing biblical and rabbinic.
Yes.
I'm a little bit confused on the term of rabbinic. Could you? I don't know. How would you explain to us what is rabbinic meaning?
Yeah.
When do you use that this is rabbinic?
Right. So the question is, what's the difference between calling these holidays biblical and calling Hanukkah rabbinic? And the answer is that the biblical text doesn't mention Hanukkah at all. Hanukkah only happened afterwards. The whole holiday that we have is because the rabbi said in response to this miracle, here's what we are going to do. Whether that's lighting candles or singing songs or whatever. That's what I mean.
One more small question?
Yes.
The other one is when we are reading the Rock of Ages and it is a joyful, everything is happy.
Yes.
But at the end, we are mentioning already our bitterness toward our people that have destroyed us, the last words. So I'm surprised that it says here, which will see all men free and tyrants disappearing. It's some kind of bitterness.
You think so? I would read it as hopeful, rather than bitter, which will see all men free, tyrants disappearing. Sound bitter to you?
It does.
Okay. I wouldn't see it that way, but...
For the tyrants, it's bitter.
Yeah, for the tyrants, it's bitter. This is true. But to come back to our main point here, because I want to make sure that we don't get lost. Sure. I want to make sure that we don't get lost here. The music, the singing that we do on Hanukkah, is not like the singing on these other days where it's a ritual that accompanies a sacrifice. The singing that's going on Hanukkah is a way to process the miracle. Take a look at it's celebration, but it's inner also. There's a philosophy behind it. Take a look at number 8. Your Moshe Isserles in the Code of Jewish Law says the custom. He's writing in Krakow in the 16th century. You see that, and the custom is to say songs and praises at the meals we add for these days, converting them into mitzvah meals. What he means by that is what's called in Hebrew, su'udat mitzvah. It's not like Passover, where you have a Seder, and there's an obligation to have a Seder. It's not like Sukkot, where there's a mitzvah of eat in the Sukkah specifically. There's no Kiddush recited on Hanukkah. Nonetheless, he says, if you sing at the meal, that makes the meal into a mitzvah meal, because you're singing about the miracle. So it's just another attempt to show you how singing becomes such a part of this holiday. I didn't really come back to the question of, so when were the candles enacted? So there is a view, not everybody's view, but there is a view, that candles initially were created to commemorate the candles of the temple, the menorah in the temple. And when the temple was destroyed, they lit candles to remember how we had a temple where the menorah was lit every night, and then that became a memorial for the events of Hanukkah. There's more to discuss about that. Maybe another year we'll have that conversation. Hillel and Shammai have a debate about adding candles, decreasing candles, correct. But now let's turn to Ma'oz Tzur. Because if this is really meant to be a song that is helping us to process the miracle of Hanukkah, I want to know, so what is this processing supposed to look like? What is it that we're supposed to get out of the out of this song experience? And by the way, if you jump down to number 12, this is something I've started doing in some of my classes, is including review questions on the source sheet. You will not be tested. Let's be clear. It's just meant to help two parties. Number one, to help me, to make sure that my class actually like gets to a point that we actually answer something specific. But also, if people want afterwards to make sure they got what was being said, you have the questions there. If someone really wants to write down answers and email them to me to make sure you got it, I will look at it, but I will not assign a grade. This is the class of pass-fail. We've now said that we've answered the first of the questions about how long Jews have been singing Ma'oz Tzur. We know it's at least 600 years. We've said there are two kinds of causes for Hallel. One is ritual, sacrifice, and the other is processing the miracle. And now we get to the song itself of Ma'oz Tzur, and we'll figure out how exactly we are processing the miracle. So looking at the text, the first verse is really an introduction. It sets the tone for the song, and it uses exactly those points that Rock of Ages omitted. So first of all, it has a prayer for the restoration of the temple, as well as bringing a thanksgiving offering, a korban todah. The sages in the Midrash have said that when the temple is rebuilt, the chief offering will be todah, will be a thanks offering to God. But it also mentions the slaughter of the blaspheming foe. The truth of the matter is, the word in the Hebrew is not blasphemy. My Hebrew speakers, the words in the Hebrew are mitzar ha-minabeach. What is minabeach? What is minabeach? Stump you, huh? Minabeach is to bark. To bark. Like a dog. To bark. It's the barking foe. Bark, bark, right. Like that. Yes, some people are better at it than I am. It's the barking foe. I think they changed it to blaspheming because they felt like that's what the meaning is. It's meant to convey that it's the enemy who blasphemes. But yeah, it's actually barking. So you look at that, and first of all, it's quoting a verse from Yeshaya, from Isaiah, regarding the fall of the Babylonians specifically, and how God prepares a slaughter for the Babylonians. And it's true. The Rock of Ages authors look at it and think to themselves, this is very harsh. We're not comfortable. And they remove that element. And I heard from some people here, right, that it's uncomfortable. But keep in mind when this song is written. 13th century Germany, 14th century Germany, right? You're talking about period of earlier you had the Crusades. Crusades are largely done by this stage. But you had the Crusades. You had the destruction of communities, right? Spire, Worms, Mainz, all of these Jewish communities that were literally massacred. And those are the ones who are writing this song about their enemy. And I just don't feel like it's for me, sitting very comfortably in Toronto in the year 2019, to criticize them for calling to God for a slaughter of the enemies who had slaughtered them. I read something recently online about a group of Jews who had planned after the Holocaust that they were going to try to poison German POWs. Right? Did you hear about this? Yeah. There was a plan to poison German POWs after the war. I have absolutely no ability to criticize them for wanting to do that. Lest somebody say, you know, I think this is too harsh, you have to keep in mind the experiences that go into a song like that. I don't think we have the right to challenge the anger of people in that situation. But then it goes verse by verse, as we noted, listing the way in which God saved us from different oppressors. So we had in the second verse, The calf-like kingdom's bondage, we pointed out that this is a reference to Mitzrayim, to Egypt. Egypt is indeed referred to by the prophet Jeremiah as Egla Yefeithia. Egla is a calf, Yefeithia is
beautiful.
It's a beautiful calf. What is the image of calling Egypt a beautiful calf? Right, so the Egyptian had many gods, one of which was indeed the calf, the bull also. What else? Well, we ended up with a golden calf, and that's actually, there are connections between that and this. But it's the image of a creature that is pampered. Is the idea of the calf. Even the term Yefeithia instead of Yafa, it's a diminutive. It's the young calf, it's pampered, it's comfortable, and that's the way that Egla is often used in Tanakh, not only for Egypt, but even for in a description of the Jews. It's used in a few places. So, the Egyptians who oppressed us, God took care of them. In the third verse, Babylon who came in and destroyed the first temple. So look at the line. To the holy abode of his word he brought me. Meaning, I actually had a temple. I had a temple in Jerusalem. God brought me there. But there too I had no rest. An oppressor came and exiled me. That's the Babylonians. For I had served aliens. Aliens here is a reference not to aliens. It's a reference to idolatry. I had served foreign gods. And had drank benumbing wine. That's a story in and of itself, for another time. Scarcely had I departed my land, when at Babylon's end, Zerubbabel came. At the end of 70 years, I was saved. Jeremiah prophesied that after 70 years of exile, we would return. And indeed, we did return. How did the Babylonian exile end? Anyone remember?
Koresh,
right. The Babylonian exile ends when the Persians defeat the Babylonians in the year 539 before the Common Era, and Cyrus, the Persian king, sends the Jews back to our land, and we were led at the time, as told in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, by Zerubbabel and Sheshbazzar. So here's my question to you. In this paragraph that talks about the Babylonian oppressor and how after 70 years we came back, why doesn't it tell us about Cyrus at all? It doesn't mention anything about Cyrus sending us home. Cyrus was great for us. He funded the temple. So why isn't Cyrus mentioned in this song? It's only praising God. The emphasis here in this song, and this starts to give us a clue of the goal of the song, is to talk about that each time we were freed from an oppressor as God did this for us. It's trying to build a case and to show how each time it's God doing it. It doesn't want to mention God's tool, Cyrus, because the emphasis is on God. Take a look at source number 10. Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, writing in Germany in the first half of the 19th century, talks about that temple. He says it had been erected by a politically dependent nation, by enslaved hands on captive soil, meaning we were still living under the Persians. You don't want to necessarily highlight that. And then he goes on to say, there's still a good side to the fact that Cyrus funded it. It was not only a monument for the loyal Jew under foreign domination, but also a testimony of the respect and reverence accorded by foreign rulers to the Jewish law. The fact that Cyrus pays for a temple is a big deal. He doesn't want you to minimize it, but at the same time in this song, that's not the point. The point is to say, look at what God did for us. In the fourth verse, it's the story of the Jews being under the hand of the Persians, and specifically Haman, the Agagite. Agag was a king of Amalek, our foe down through the ages in Tanakh. And God, you saved us from them. He wanted to sever the towering cypress. That's a reference to the hero of the Purim story, to Mordechai. He is called the cypress in rabbinic literature. He's also a Benjaminite, because some of his lineage is from the tribe of Benjamin. And that's what you see there. And then finally, you get to the story of Hanukkah. Look how many paragraphs it took to get to Hanukkah. Right? You had the introductory paragraph. Then you had the Egyptians. Then you had the Babylonians. Then you have the Persians. And finally, one paragraph before the end, we get to Hanukkah. Okay. What did we say here? Greeks gathered against me then in Hasmonean days. The Hasmoneans, again, were the heroes. They breached the walls of my towers. They defiled all the walls. The Talmud speaks of a specific effort by the Greeks. You know, the temple is described in Isaiah as Beit Tfilah, a house of prayer, l'chol ha'amin, for everybody. It's not just for us. Non-Jews were allowed to come and bring sacrifices, you know, to the temple. However, there was one area that was only for Jews. Only for those who honor the covenant. You want to come in here? Well, then you have to convert. Otherwise, you don't get to go in. And it was a barrier before that. And the Talmud describes how the Greeks were so angry that there was a spot that wasn't for them that they broke 13 holes in that barrier. They broke down the reference here. They breached the walls of my towers, and they contaminated the oil. Right? They defiled the oil that would have been used for the service. And from the one remnant of the flasks, a miracle was wrought for the roses. They translate it as roses. In Hebrew, the word is shoshanim. Unclear whether it means roses or lilies. That's a longer discussion. But we often use it to mean rose. The miracle was wrought for the roses from one remnant of the flask. I turned back to Rabbi Hirsch again, because he's just beautiful in his language. Take a look at source number 11. He describes the importance of that one bit of oil that was left. One single pure spark, loyally treasured in but one single Jewish heart, is sufficient for God to set aflame once more the whole spirit of Judaism. And if all the oil, if all the forces that were to have preserved the light of God in Israel were to be misused for the light of paganism, even then, one little crucible of oil, one heart, which in a forgotten hidden corner imprinted with a high priest's seal has faithfully remained untouched and undefiled, this one crucible is sufficient to become the salvation of the entire sanctuary when the right time and hour has come. That's the significance. You like it? No, that's a great language. This is a translation. He wrote it in German, where it's probably just one really long word. But it's the importance of that last jug of oil. And look how the verse ends. Men of insight, 8 days established for song and jubilation. In Hebrew, kav ushir or ananim. They created song. Again, the importance of the song in that celebration. And that brings us to the last verse, which, as I said, is written later than the previous ones. Which enemy are we talking about here? I asked before. We didn't know. Take a look. Bear your holy one. This is a plea to God. Bear your holy arm and hasten the end for salvation. Avenge the vengeance of your servants' blood from the wicked nation. For the triumph is too long delayed for us. There is no end to days of evil. Repel the red one in the nethermost shadow. We're in the last verse of the Moses sort, in source number 9. The last verse of Moses sort. Who is the red one?
No,
not the communists either. Sorry? In Hebrew, it's the Admon. That should give you a clue. Edom. Right? Edom. Edom is the Admoni. They are descendants of Esau, who was called Admoni. It means the red one. That's what it means. But Edom is identified by the rabbis as Rome. This is a reference to Rome. Now, when a Jew, at any point in the last 2,000 years, has referred to Rome, what were they really referring to? The Catholic Church. Right? That's what this is a reference to. Repel the red one. And then, he had a very funny term. In the nethermost shadow, the Hebrew, Betzel Salmon. Salmon, like Salmavet, can mean something that is very, you know, that is buried below, or it can mean darkness. I have a friend who writes to me, Ram, and I heard him point something else out. The word Salmon is a very odd word. Not beyond the pale to be used. But I will take another sheet on here and show you what he pointed out. Sorry. The word Salmon, as written in Hebrew, I left the cap off of this too long. No, it's okay. This is the word Salmon. If I, no, not Solomon, different word. If I cover up the Bab Nun, you get Salem. Bingo, Salem is a cross. Those who are in the shadow of the cross, the sail of the Salem. This is a veiled reference to the one who the author views in 13th century Germany, 14th century Germany, as the last oppressor. The Sail Salmon is a reference to the Pope. Essentially, the red one, and think of the red and the cardinals, I don't know how far back that goes, in the shadow of the cross. And it pleads with God to restore the seven shepherds. The seven shepherds is a prophecy from the book of Micha about seven leaders who would lead the Jews going forward. So that's the song. That's Ma'oz Tzur. It's way more than Rock of Ages. There's a lot going on here, and we've just really scratched the surface. So what emerges from here as the essence of Hanukkah? How is it that Ma'oz Tzur is supposed to help us process the miracle? So I see it's getting late, so I will answer my question. Number one, the recognition that the salvation comes from God. We don't mention, by and large, Zerubbabel gets a mention there, but other than that, we don't mention human beings who redeemed us. It's all about God. Cyrus doesn't show up, for example. That's number one. It's teaching us that God is the source of the salvation. That's what we are meant to learn as we process the miracle of Hanukkah, which makes a lot of sense. Because the miracle of Hanukkah, in terms of the war side of it, could very easily be cast as a simple human victory. Right? There are people who want to cast 1948 and 1967 as just, we won. Somehow our strategies, they made mistakes, whatever it is, take God out of the picture. This is telling us, read the story in light of God being the one to manage things. That's number one. Number two, it took us all the way until paragraph 5 out of 6 to get to Hanukkah. Why? It's the Hanukkah song. Yeah.
It's an ongoing journey. Like, it's an ongoing struggle, an ongoing journey.
Right.
You can see it reflected in the Passover Haggadah as well, so especially.
Correct. It's a sense that Hanukkah is part of a greater pattern of progress in history, like the songs that we sing at the end of the Haggadah, correct? We want to place it within the greater timeline. It's possible that Ma'oz Tzur was originally written and intended to be sung on all these holidays, but each one only gets one mention. We're supposed to see this pattern of progress in history with multiple redemptions. And the third and last point, it takes us back to the first verse. When it asks God, restore my house of prayer, there we will bring a thanksgiving offering, it says, we're not done. Even if we are free, even if we are able to sing and to celebrate, and we're no longer under the threat of the Egyptians and the Greeks and the Babylonians and the Persians and all of that, nonetheless, our goal is not yet achieved. We're still waiting for Tikkun Beit Tfilati. We're waiting for the house of our prayer to be established. So, answering the last two questions out of the review questions. From which persecutors were we rescued in each paragraph of Ma'oz Tzur? So now we know for each one. And then what are the three lessons we can learn from Ma'oz Tzur in processing the miracle of Hanukkah? The recognition that salvation comes from God and not to delude ourselves into thinking it's all us. The sense that Hanukkah is part of a greater pattern of progress in history. And the awareness that the goal is not yet achieved. We're still waiting on the house of our prayer. The last source that I brought you there in number 13, I had a professor in Yeshiva University, Professor Orlian, and his son posted this online. It's a magnificent document, which, just in one short double-sided page, he presents the texts that are the source for Ma'oz Tzur, meaning each line in Ma'oz Tzur can be traced to a biblical verse, can be traced to a midrash, so it's in Hebrew, so it's really for Hebrew readers. But it's but you can actually go there and see all the different texts that go into creating Ma'oz Tzur. It's a fascinating read. Yes?
Yes, how long have we been singing
Ma'oz? Right, so at least 600 years, it appears. We don't know exactly, but at least 600, because we have the texts that show that in the 14th century it was being sung Friday night at the Shabbos table.
So
on Hanukkah.
Are we considering Hanukkah Yamim Tovim?
Yes, I think so. I would think so, yes. Eddie.
They're all pages song.
Yeah.
Are we in English or is it in English?
Only in English. It would make for an English-speaking audience. Yeah, Rock of Ages, as far as I know, was only created in English, and it rhymes that way. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And a wonderful